Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. My name is Peter Florence. I'm a Ledbury Poetry Festival patron. And this was already going to be an unusual event. It became slightly more unusual when Michael contracted COVID. So he is here, but he is here in large. He's going to be beaming in from his study to give the lecture he would have given here on this stage. In the context of this technological wonder, I'd also like to say that this is due to Andy and to Meg, who's working the live stream up there with the audience online. Thank you to you as well, because this has been quite a challenge and it's been met heroically. Thank you. Now, it only remains for me to say that you all know Michael Wood. He is the most eloquent, articulate, brilliant communicator of history that the BBC has ever known, I think. This, oddly, is probably, barring family FaceTime calls, the most intimate audience he will ever have spoken to on camera. So it's a real privilege to have him. Michael, I think, is about to appear on here, and I can see him on the screen over there. Thank you very much for being here. And thank you, and well, I'd say thank you for not being here as well, as a go-carrier. But the floor is yours. I'll be back up here to help with questions in 45 minutes. Thank you very much, and welcome to Ledbury.
Thank you very much. I'm so sorry that I can't be with you today in person, but as you've sort of struck down by COVID after being so careful for more than 2 years. And I'd been particularly looking forward to coming to Ledbury, which is a first for me. But a copy of the film that we made about Dufu for the BBC just early in the lockdown, with Sir Ian McKellen doing the readings, can be seen at the festival tomorrow lunchtime. And I hope you get a chance to see it. It was very well received in China. One or two literary critics thought that it was the best documentary on Chinese literature that they'd ever seen. And the popular reaction was really tremendous. The most delightful of all was the number of Chinese viewers who said that Ian McKellen looked exactly like Dufu. So in the meantime today, I hope this afternoon we can just enjoy reflecting on somebody who's often regarded as one of the greatest poets in the world, Stephen Owen, who completed the first complete Dufu in English, six-volume translation in 2017, said, "There's Dante, there's Shakespeare, and there's Dufu. And these poets are the poets who helped establish the emotional vocabulary of their cultures." A quick word of introduction that we often forget: the Chinese tradition of poetry is the oldest living. It goes back more than 3,000 years. The oldest poems of the great anthology, the Book of Songs, this great collection of poems on love and war and agriculture and festivals, is older than the Iliad and the Odyssey. So this is a very long tradition, maintained tenaciously and loved by the Chinese people through thick and thin. There are many great ages, of course, but I think most people tend, if you ask them, to agree that the greatest era of Chinese poetry was the Tang Dynasty between, let's say, around 600 and 900 AD. I suppose you'd call it the age of Beowulf in England. About 50,000 poems survive from the Tang Dynasty by more than 2,000 men and women. And they're still loved and learned and studied, at least the best of them, recited in households that care about the continuance of China's great tradition in the face of the crushing inroads of modernity that they and all of us face in the 21st century. Famous poets, of course, are still very well known in China: Li Bai, Wang Wei, Du Fu himself. Indeed, I discovered just before I left China that autumn, when the outbreak was just beginning, it's still possible in quite a few places in the countryside to hear unaccompanied plain song singing of Tang Dynasty poetry handed down among ordinary Chinese poetry lovers in local family poetry schools and clubs and so on. So the tradition has survived not only in book form, but even in oral poetry. Now, Du Fu himself wasn't famous in his own day. He died in obscurity and poverty. It was only after his death, which was 770, that his reputation grew. And it's in the 9th century, you start to get critics saying, since the dawn of time, there was nobody like him. And then from the 11th century onwards, he starts to be seen as the conscience of the nation, almost, the great kind of moral voice of the nation. And then you get big editions and collections. His poetry is collected as far as they could find it. And the places where he stayed on his wanderings in the last stages of his life, when he really just was a wanderer from place to place, they start to be marked and commemorated, as they still are. So if you, you know, if you think of Stratford-upon-Avon to Shakespeare, it's Chengdu for Du Fu. So that began a long time ago. And the way that he was seen in China he always has a kind of moral force to it. I'm terribly struck by looking at later great poets. Take the most famous Chinese woman poet, Li Qing Zhao. In the collapse of China in 1127, her chief anxiety is to save her precious scrolls of Du Fu as she travels from place to place to escape the invasions. Zheng Yunduan in the 14th century, the same in the cataclysms that ended the Yuan dynasty. Even the greatest of the modern Chinese poets, Zheng Zhen, during the Taiping War, the worst war of the 19th century, he made a dangerous journey on foot to Du Fu's thatched cottage in Chengdu to just sit there and meditate on the meaning of Du Fu's poetry amid the horrors that were all around him. So for all of these famous poets and literary people, poetry was the vital force, and Du Fu was the lodestar. And that continued into our own time. You can see online a wonderful clip from the Poetry Society of the little town of Midland, Michigan, from 2011, where a retired Chinese American, Li Tian, is asked to read us his favorite poem. And he introduces it by saying that when he was young, he remembers seeing a line from this poem daubed in paint on the walls of a great burning building near Shanghai during the Japanese invasion and occupation in World War II. The line that he saw, very famous line, "The state is destroyed, but the country remains." "I didn't choose this poem," says Li Tian. "The poem chose me." And since 1949, Du Fu's escaped the censure of the communists who wanted to destroy old thoughts and old ways and old customs and all that because of his profound sympathy for the ordinary people. And he's still part of the school curriculum. And more important, still read and discussed by poetry societies and clubs all over China. In the West, Du Fu's come into his own really only since World War II. Translations of Du Fu have been recent in terms of modern Chinese translations of Chinese poetry in the West. And you can find a lot of good translations now. And in China, a great 30-year project came to an end in 2014, I think, with the publication of the definitive edition of all of his poems. Stephen Owen's complete English version came out in 2017. And the French diplomat Nicolas Chapuis producing a wonderful French edition of complete Du Fu is in progress now. And Chapuis defends translation as an essential cultural act in our world. And he memorably said in an interview that Chinese literature is universal and that through translation, it can and does transcend the barriers of language. So it's in that spirit that I hope to offer you a few thoughts. I hasten to add, of course, as a non-expert. First of all, then, who was Dufu? You may have come across him on Radio 4 recently on In Our Time, the Melvyn Bragg program, sharing a program with his contemporary Lee Bai. But I'm sure I wasn't the only listener to come away feeling disappointed that there was no real feel for his life, let alone his poetry. He certainly would have deserved a program all of his own, as would Lee Bai. He was born in 712, the son of moderate level civil servants, middle ranking, but at the beginning of a truly great epoch of the Tang dynasty, under the brilliant young emperor Xuanzong, the brilliant emperor, as his civil servants liked to call him. Those were the days when civil servants were praised them, praised the culture of their leaders. It was a great age of cultural, artistic, and literary brilliance. And Dufu talks later, and remembers with riveting precision some of these childhood memories when, as a tiny boy, on the fringe of the court, he saw some of the great artists. He saw the great dancers and heard the greatest court musicians playing. And experienced the rush of excitement, not only the charisma of the rule and the emperor, but the power of live literary activity. And his memory in particular, which you'll see tomorrow if you see the film, we tried to bring this to life in the film with a fantastic performance by a modern Chinese dancer who recreated this scene. Almost 50 years later, Dufu recalled as a five-year-old seeing the great dancer. This is what he said. He often wrote rather useful and moving introductions to the circumstances under which he wrote his poems. And this is what he said about the dancer. I remember when I was still a child, aged five, I saw the famous dancer Kung Sun perform the sword dance. A rhythm, a passionate power, was superb, a strength, a freedom. The people crowded round to look, almost breathless. Watching her, you felt heaven struggling against the earth. When she bent back, you saw nine suns falling, shot down by Yi, the god of archers. And when she leapt, you imagine the gods astride flying dragons in the clouds. When she advanced, you expected thunder and lightning from a gathering storm. When she stopped, you saw the soft light over a vast, calm sea. That's the old man looking back, remembering with such intensity the childhood experience, the persistence of childhood memories. And those things mark you, don't they? You there as a young child, he saw the power of art. Let's put it that way, the power of art and how art could be transmitted. Dance, poetry, music, how it could be transmitted from one generation to the next. He wrote poetry when he was young. He tells us in a rather self-mocking autobiographical tract, loosely called My Splendid Years, written at a point when his whole career was a total disaster and everything had gone wrong, you know, but stories of my prime. When I was still only in my seventh year, he said, and my mind was already full of heroic deeds. My first poem, he says, was about the phoenix, the harbinger of a new age of wisdom. He's at the beginning of the great reign of the great emperor, Xuanzong. When I was nine, I'd already written enough poems to fill a satchel. And at 14, I began to recite my poems in public. And people compared me with some of the great poems of the day. And then there's a very revealing passage about his temperament. He says, I was already temperamental. and I was already over fond of wine. I needed it to soften an uncompromising hatred of wickedness and hypocrisy. You get the impression of somebody who, idealistic and passionate and imaginative, but perhaps unwilling to take the world for what it is rather than what it could be. Now, in terms of his collected poetry, there's almost nothing from his early days, and that's probably due to him. I think what happened was that it was in his 40s, surprisingly, that's a long period of time, isn't it? Shakespeare had almost given up writing altogether by that time. His career was over. But for Dufu, he'd been an occasional poet and looked after the family estates and traveled and done this and that. But it was in the 40s that he found his voice, and therefore he edited his collected works to that end, I think. He tells us he had a great time when he was young. He was a great horseman. And, you know, the first few years of my 20s, I played and I roamed. In the spring, I sang on the terraces where the poets competed. Summer, I hunted among the green hills. In the winter, I whistled for the falcons in the purple oak forests, and chased wild beasts on cloud and snow ridge. I trailed my hems wherever sweet ale was served, and I drank myself sick. You can see he looks back thinking what a wasted youth it was. But some of his early poems do contain elegant and beautiful reflections on friendship, especially the friendship with the great poet Li Bai. This is a short poem, a very famous poem in China, about Li Bai, with whom he had an incredibly intense relationship for a couple of years. Then they parted and they never saw each other again. And in the interim, Li Bai, it's believed, drowned in a boating accident. This is the poem. Separation by death, in the end you get over. Separation in life is a continuing grief. No word from you, old friend, but you've been in my dreams as if you know how much I miss you. I feel as if you're no longer mortal. The distance between us is so great. The setting moon spills light on the ceiling, and for a moment I think it's your face. The waters are deep. The waves are wide. Don't let the river gods take you. And they did, of course. So his surviving works date mainly from after the age of 40. And as I said, I think although he realized that good as he was as a poet when he was young, he found his true voice in middle age. And when he became a wanderer with nothing to lose except his life and the lives of his wife and children. And what changed his life was the An Lu Shan War, which broke out in 755, by which time he was 43. This was one of the most cataclysmic events in Chinese history. 30 million people are missing from the censuses taken before the war and afterwards. 30 million people, either displaced as refugees, killed in war, died of famine, and all the rest. And many historians see it as a turning point in Chinese history. And of course, it finished off the reign of the brilliant emperor, Xuanzong. So the great age of idealism and optimism comes crashing down. It's now that Dufu, with a young family, married quite late, his 40s, he finds his voice, which is about the condition of the people and the suffering of ordinary people in war. And let me read you now one of his most famous poems. It's called 500 Words on the Road to Fengxian. At the year's ending, a bitter wind scours the high ridges. I set out a lone traveller at midnight, fingers too cold to tie my broken belt. At dawn, I pass the imperial palace. Here at the hot springs, the emperor entertains his court, and music echoes round the hills. Only the rich and powerful may bathe here, for the silk they wear was woven by poor people, women whose husbands are beaten for their taxes. The halls are full of ladies as fair as goddesses. The scent of perfume wafts with each captivating figure, clothed in warm furs of sable, entertained with the finest music, pipes and strings, fed with camel hump soup and oranges ripened in the frost. Behind the red lacquered gates, wine is left to sour, meat to rot. Outside the gates are the bones of the frozen and the starved. And then, making a cut in the poem, he finally gets to the village where he's put his family for safety. And this is what he saw. When I got back home, wailing filled the house. My infant boy had died of hunger. Why should I hold back my grief when even the neighbors in the village are crying for us? I'm ashamed of being a father, so poor that I caused my son to die for lack of food. How could I know that the autumn harvest still would not save the poor from disaster? And I'm one of the privileged. If my life is so bitter, then how much worse is the life of the common people? He'd found his voice then. He will write on all aspects of life. He will write poems about the minutiae of life, in his tiny little shack that he built himself. He'll write about planting seed, planting bushes, growing things, keeping chickens, meeting a deer, the stuff of everyday life. Everything is part of his pen, if you like. But above all, it's this sense of the great tragedies of war. There's wonderful poems that are almost Kipling-esque in their ventriloquy of the ordinary soldier, you know, that the recruits marching across the river bridge in a village with the dust burgeoning up. And the poet asks the soldiers, where are you heading? And one of the soldiers stops and says, you can almost hear him in the voice of Danny Deever or one of those Kipling soldiers, you know, oh, it's very kind of you to ask, sir. You've surely heard, we're out on the, you know, and so on. Absolutely wonderful sense of ordinary people's voices and so on. All this time, he tried to get a job, steady income, look after his family, but he failed the national exams twice, never attained a proper rank in the civil service. He suffered from malaria, he had diabetes, and gradually you can see this decline of his health from vigorous youth to a struggling old age. And this comes out in the wonderful poem I mentioned, the Midland, Michigan poem read by Li Tian. This is the famous poem. It's one of the most famous poems in Chinese. It's called simply, with wonderful understatement, Spring Scene. And it takes place in the capital, Chang'an, after its fall to the rebels, when Du Fu is on his own as a prisoner, probably working as some kind of, you know, orderly or ferrying stuff from place to place. Here's the poem. The state is destroyed, but the country remains. In the city in spring, grass and weeds grow everywhere. Grieving for the times, even the blossom sheds tears. Beacon fires have been burning for 3 months now. A letter from home would be worth 10,000 in gold. Scratching my head, my white hair's getting thinner. Soon it won't even hold a hairpin. I love the movement in the poem from the grand epic sweep of the destroyed capital, the greatest city on earth, and the little detail of the white hair and the hairpin at the end, the beacon fires burning ominously, and the weeds growing, and the spring blossom, well, as it always does, coming back, whatever the disasters in the human world. And that moment really begins he decides that he's never going to make it he's never going to be able to join the civil service, get an income or whatever. So he packs up and takes his family as a kind of Swiss Family Robinson, almost, in a huge arc around China, going from place to place, seeking patrons, desperately trying to eke a bit of land on which he can build a thatched cottage, plant some food, harvest some food, and so on. And that's the journey that we followed in the film, and I hope you'll get to see tomorrow. And that's the journey that I'm hoping to write about in the book. I should qualify what Peter said in that the manuscript is delivered in September. The book won't be around until next year, but maybe we can all meet up in person next year and look at the book in more detail. The places where he stayed were singled out a couple of centuries later, and most of them now have little memorial halls. And, Dufu's thatched cottage has been rebuilt outside Chengdu in a rather lovely location by the rivers. And you can see the places where for a time he escaped the horrors of war. Lovely detail in Chengdu. Outside the city, there are a few worldly affairs, he said. Right by our side, there's a clear stream to dispel this stranger's grief. Clouds of dragonflies hover, rising and falling. A pair of ducks dive and swim together. I've chosen a place to grow old in. Far now from the capital, I've become a farmer. And then he turns south over the great mountain spine, the center of China, from the Yellow River Plain down to the Yangtze and to the gorges. And he spends a couple of years in the gorges, and which, of course, we've filmed and traveled through in the documentary, although you can no longer see the magnificent scale of the gorges as was before the building of the dam. But it's fabulously impressive. And something in that landscape obviously appealed to him, because it's there that he wrote a huge number of his poems, 400 of his poems, more than a quarter of his poems. And among them, Stephen Owen says, the greatest words in the Chinese language. And I've chosen one poem from that period to just give you the full poem. I hope you enjoy this. And we'll talk about it in a minute. In the evening of the year, yin and yang hurry the shortening daylight. On the sky's edge, frost and snow clear in the cold of night. Drums and horns of the fifth watch give notes both strong and sad. In the three gorges, the river of stars, reflections stirring, shaking, weeping in the wilderness. How many families know of war and loss? The people's songs rise from fishermen and woodcutters, tales of sleeping dragon and leaping horse, the old heroes who've all turned to dust. All word of events in the human world lost in these vast silent spaces. And perhaps here a comparison with Shakespeare is not inapposite, although, of course, Shakespeare is a dramatic poet, not a lyric poet like Dufu. But, in Shakespeare's sonnets, for example, if you take a sonnet like Sonnet 33, Full Many a Glorious Morning Have I Seen, it's another poem in which the poet sets the vast beauty of nature and the natural world against human feelings. Shakespeare's poem, of course, flooded with Christian ideas about the meaning of time, whereas Dufu's one might call a secular vision of Zen. But all the same, the two poets are quarrying the extremes of language, poets in their full powers, if you like. Chinese language, remember, has no verbal tenses. It has no direct or indirect articles. It can have extremely ambiguous sentence order. You can be not quite sure what is the subject of a sentence in some cases. So there's an ex- extreme openness of possibilities in terms of meaning, and a great openness to interpretation. The reading of a Chinese poem is also an act of interpretation. And the scholars, the experts, think that this moment in the Gorges in the 760s signals a great change in Chinese poetry, a point when a literature is transformed into and enriched into a new way of seeing the world. We talk about these kind of changes, don't we? For example, in English literature, English poetry in the late 16th century, that's when English literature moves into a different level of complexity and ambiguity and richness. It happened perhaps in France later in the 19th century. But in all of these, there's a qualitative change in the nature of poetry. And in China, this is the moment when Du Fu's late poems, that these 400 poems written in the Gorges, produce a template for future literature where the poetry can hold multiple meanings and multiple levels. And two great sequences that he wrote at that time, one of five and one of eight poems, are known as Autumn Wastes and Autumn Meditations. And if you're minded to look at them, they take some getting used to, but they're amazing pieces of work. These are the poems that Stephen Owen calls the greatest words in the Chinese language. I'll just give you a tiny line or two of the Autumn Wastes just to tantalize you with the mysterious flavor. This is the opening verse of Autumn Wastes, and there's two references in it that we wouldn't get without a little steer. When he talks about the star, the well-roped star of the barbarians, he's talking about they're not in China proper, you see. You're down in the south here, and there's a different sky and a different star. It's another world. And when he talks about the Unicorn Hall, he's talking about the hall in the capital where portraits of the famous civil servants were put to commemorate them after their service, where, of course, he knows he will never be. But this is the opening of Autumn Wastes. The autumn wastes are each day wilder. Cold in the river, the blue sky stirs. I've moored my boat to the well-roped star of the barbarians. My ambition was to be seen in the Unicorn Hall, but my years decline. I'm old now. On the great river, autumn is soon in spate. In the empty gorge, the night is full of noises. And it was in the Gorges, incidentally, that the social event took place that I mentioned at the start. Du Fu's memory of the dancer when he was five. So this is Du Fu's now, what is he, 12, he's in his mid-50s. And this is his preface to his poem, which is worth us recalling here. He says this, and it's absolutely brilliantly precise. On the 15th of November, 767, at the house of the vice prefect, I saw a performance of the sword dance by the Lady Li from Linying. Marveling at her agility, I asked her who her teacher was. And she said, I'm a pupil of Kung Sun. And I remember that day when I was still a child. Since then, more than 50 years have passed so fast, like the turning of a palm. Stormy waves of war have enfolded our royal house in gloom. The pupils of the Peach Garden, the Royal Dance School, have scattered like disappearing mist. The brilliant feasts, the music, and the song have ended. And now I'm an old man who does not know where he's going. So after 2 years in the Gorges, something moves Du Fu on. All that time he's cultivated his two plots, his orange groves, he's grown his own food, he's had something of a social life down in town on the river stations. But something now moves him on. And the final stop in his journey is the great city of Changsha, on the Xiang River, down in the south. And Changsha had become a place of exile during the war. And there, Du Fu met a number of people who he'd known. And amazingly, one of the people that he met there was a very, very famous court musician, the greatest of the emperor's court musicians, Li Guinyan. And we would love to know whether Du Fu actually collaborated with the musician. The question of how much Tang poetry was actually set to music is a truly intriguing one, which is slightly obsessing me at the moment, I must say. I'm in touch with a lady who teaches in her home a group of poetry lovers in Changsha and has gathered together some of these oral traditions from the countryside of sung versions of these poems. But I haven't yet got to the bottom of how far back some of these settings go. But among Du Fu's poems, he wrote a little four-line poem. And again, it's one of the most famous poems in China. And it's one that every Chinese person knows because it's one of Du Fu's poems, which is a set text at school. So you not only analyze this poem and pass it, but you learn it exactly, point by point. And it's a tiny, almost inconsequential poem, you might think. It's called Meeting Li Guinyan Again, South of the River. Here it is. I often used to see you at Prince Qi's mansion. How many times have I heard you play at Lord Sui's home? Truly, the landscape south of the river is beautiful. And now we meet again with the blossom falling. And of course, one of the great things about the poem is the sense of the blossom is falling and the age is at an end. So it's short as it is, rich in symbolism. And Du Fu died in or near Changsha in 770, aged in his late 50s, and died pretty much in obscurity. Some of his late poems, he suggests that maybe his poetry won't be remembered, although he'd obviously taken care to have it copied, to carry it with him, to keep his precious scrolls of poetry in a box. His sons, who were with him when he died in Changsha and initially buried him down there, and a branch of the family stayed down there and still claims descent from him today, they obviously made a real effort to try to pass the poetry on. And an edition of about between 200 and 300 of his poems was made not long after he died. And I'm just going to leave you with two quotations here for us to think about. First of all is Du Fu's own reflection on his craft. This is what he wrote. Poetry was my family's business. The early writers first made poetry take wings and soar. Later ones have enriched their works. Each generation produces its own fruits. Writers stand in different ranks, but true fame surely is no random favor. Great literature is for 1,000 ages. Whether it succeeds or not, in the heart, you know in the heart. Whether it succeeds or not, you know in the heart. And I think one of the things that comes out about Du Fu in the modern world, now we've got a complete span of his work, is it's not just those great set piece poems about war and loss and so on. It's the portrait of a human being in all its detail, with all his foibles, recording the minutiae of daily life, the planting, the harvesting, building a thatched house, struggling after a storm in which the thatched roof had been blown off and the local kids are pinching the remains of the thatch. You know, his moral stature, of course, is great. But what's appealing to us now, in 2022, I think, is also that sense of the entire output, the portrait of one human life from the 8th century. Nothing was not his subject. And in that, I think he's unique among poets. So that's my brief sketch of Dufu. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed the readings. I hope you enjoy the film tomorrow. But to conclude, I came across this little quotation by an 11th century Chinese critic writing about Dufu, which perhaps as poetry lovers, we might all take to heart. This is what Wei Tai wrote about Dufu in the 11th century. Poetry presents the thing in order to convey the feeling. It should be precise about the thing and reticent about the feeling. For as soon as the mind responds and connects with the thing, the feeling shows in the words. This is how poetry enters deeply into us. If the poet presents directly feelings that overwhelm him and keeps nothing back to linger as an aftertaste, he stirs us superficially. He cannot start the hands and feet involuntarily waving and tapping in time. Far less strengthen morality and refine culture, set heaven and earth in motion, and call up the spirits.
Thanks.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much. And we are all, I think, here thrilled to see you and to learn so much of this. We've got a quarter of an hour for questions from the audience, and there is a roving mic which we'll bring round to you so posterity and everybody online can hear you if you'd like to ask. If anybody would like to ask, please put up a hand and we'll come to you. But whilst we do that, can I kick off with the first question, Michael, which is...
Yeah.
You mentioned that this 7th century language is the time of our Beowulf. To what degree is the language that Dufu was writing in or composing in the same language that Yang Lian writes in today? Is there that continuity and tenacity of language in China? And forgive the sheer ignorance of that question, but I just don't know.
Yeah, but there is continuity. Obviously, there have been major changes in the Chinese language. And, you know, the modernization of the Chinese language in the early 20th century and a whole series of developments. So you're not... that the poems have to be done in today in modernized, if you like. So it's not... you're not studying the exact text that Dufu wrote, although of course you can study it in a parallel text if you wish. And yes, things move on. And for the ordinary Chinese student or somebody at school, it's recognizably the same language. It's recognizably the same poem, but it has moved on in the way it's expressed today. That's as far as I understand it.
Thank you. Gentleman down in the front here.
Hello, thanks very much. It was very impressive. I just wanted to ask, you mentioned earlier in the lecture about how the scholarship on Dufu has only really dates back to just after the Second World War. And I was thinking that... you didn't mention anything about the connection with the work that Pound and others did earlier. that really put Chinese poetry on the map through things like Cathay and later the Chinese cantos. And I was wondering if that was because of the relationship with the Japanese translations. Where does Dufu fit into that kind of continuity between the earlier work that was done by Western scholars, based, I think, on what they knew through the Japanese mediation?
It's a really great question, and to be quite honest, I had a whole page to talk about Cathay, which I thought for the purposes of this afternoon maybe I should cut. But it is worth recalling this, especially in the 100th anniversary celebrations of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland, of what an important role Eastern poetry, Chinese poetry, played in the development of European modernism just before and into the First World War. I mean, Cathay, I think, was published in late 1915. And, I mean, curiously enough, Peter mentioned The Age of Beowulf, but the original edition of Cathay, I think, has 14 translations from the Chinese, which, of course, Pound didn't read Chinese. He was taking them from the notes of Ernest Fenollosa, but the plus a translation of the old English poem, The Seafarer. Pound was obviously in searching for these new ways of seeing, new ways of expression. He also went back to our poetic tradition as well for that book. You know, there've been lots of criticisms of Pound's Chinese translations, but that's to miss the point that he understood that absolutely crucial thing about you know, the Chinese language, and that with no tenses and no direct articles, the images unfold. I think he uses the expression like images in a cinema film for a while, and it was T.S. Eliot who said that Pound became the inventor of Chinese poetry for our time, you know. So that was an absolutely signal moment, was the publication of Cathay. The curious relationship of Dufu to all that is this, that, of course, Fenollosa and Pound were accessing the poems of Li Bai and describe him through his Japanese name. And so it was Li Bai who would become the figure who was most influential in the Cathay project and afterwards. And after the First World War, Dufu was, the great translator was Arthur Whaley. And Whaley didn't approach Dufu. For some reason, either he found Dufu too difficult, which seems incredible, but he wrote a whole book on Li Bai, among other poets. But not Dufu. So things passed Dufu by until the 1950s, when you get William Hung's book and David Hawkes's little study of the 30 key poems of Dufu, and A.C. Graham and others. So the real beginning of translation of Dufu comes after the Second World War. There were a handful of Dufu poems were published by Herbert Giles in his History of Chinese Literature in 1901, and a few in a French translation in the 1860s, but almost nothing. It's very interesting. So the great opening up of modernism and Eastern poetry through Cathay, which was so influential, it's very easy for us to forget this. And I think for everybody who's interested in poetry, you can still get it in a very cheap paperback edition. It's an eye-opener. It's a really, really brilliant and fantastic book, you know. And you can see why friends of Pound in the First World War wrote to him saying, when they read those poems, saying that these poems are something completely new. They completely express our own condition. And you know, Gaudier, Breschka's writing from the trenches, you know, that a completely new voice was possible in Western poetry. So it's a wonderful subject, of course. I mean, a subject that the Ledbury Festival might wish on a future occasion with the right expert to look at, you know, the relationship of Cathay and Pound and everything else to the rise of modernism.
Can I just say, I've over the years been to quite a lot of literature festivals, and that is the best answer to the best question I have ever heard at a literature festival. there's a question up the back.
Can you tell us a little bit about how Du Fu's poems got disseminated after he died? You said his sons published an edition of 200 poems, but there were many more poems than that. How they became recognised and admired within China?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. And it's one of those questions, like many questions, where you realise nobody's quite answered it in any of the literature. And I haven't yet got a full answer to how it worked. You know, all the way through his journeys, he'll stay somewhere. A local governor will be kind to him. He'll write him a little poem and give it as a gift, you know. There's even one poem where he says, this particular local administrator was so kind to me, but in the pouring rain, slipping down the muddy bank to get back to my boat in the rain, I didn't thank him properly. What a good man he was. And so I didn't thank you properly. So I'm writing you this poem now. So there are these occasional poems which must have been preserved by Du Fu, or possibly by the people who he sent the poems to. But quite a number of poems must have been collected. He was obviously acknowledged to be a very gifted poet, you know, and he did jobs for people, you know, he took commissions, he wrote commemorative poems and stuff like that. But after his death, the edition produced, one imagines with the help of his sons, is between 200 and 300 poems out of more than 1,400. And you can see in the Song Dynasty, the, you know, electrifying effect of literary people searching high and low for new editions of unknown Du Fu poems. It's like getting Bob Dylan bootlegs, you know, have you ever heard this one? You know, there's a letter from one Song Literatus to another saying, you're not going to believe this, but I've actually turned up a treasure trove of nearly 100 Du Fu poems that I didn't know before. So how exactly that happened is not clear. Big printed editions were published in the Song Dynasty, you know, especially in the, you know, in the 1100s and then later 1300s, 1400s. And then under the Manchus, when the Manchus conquered China in 1644, the great emperor Kangxi, who was anxious to appear more Chinese than Chinese, you know, and really pay homage to the greatness of Chinese civilization, in the early 1700s, commissioned the complete Tang poems and put in charge a family friend who he'd grown up with from Nanjing, and they searched high and wide among private collectors, you know, people who'd got manuscripts, and these were all gathered together, and that's how the complete Tang poems was put together. So I've asked Chinese friends, is it possible that other Du Fu poems escaped the early 1700s complete edition and that were discovered at a later time, but nobody can quite answer whether that's true or not, you know. Certainly when you see these great later poets like Li Jingzhao with their guarding their precious scrolls of Du Fu with their lives whilst China fell around them in flames, you know, you see how valued these things were, you know.
Can we take, just for geography, that question first and then that one, please?
Are the scrolls collected somewhere for scholars to look at in Beijing or elsewhere?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yes. are the scrolls of Du Phu collected somewhere for scholars to look at and admire, either in Beijing or elsewhere?
No, sadly, and as far as I'm aware, there is no autograph of Du Phu. There is no original, uncontested sample of his handwriting. You know, there are later copies by scholars who tried to produce as accurate an impression as they could of his handwriting. Because, of course, in China, handwriting is the most revealing aspect of personality, you know. Whether it's dashing or studied or, you know, the style with which you write, it tells you about the person, you know. But there's no stuff like that, you know. We're really dependent on the great Song dynasty printed editions from the 11th century onwards.
A question down here.
Thank you for your both scholarship and the excitement you've given us. But I was thinking of what Simon Armitage was saying last week, and that his work has benefited immensely from his love of Hardy and a number of other influences. But it seems, from a cursory look at Du Phu, that he was his own example most of the time, whereas Li Bai was much more looking at legends and the freedom of thought with stories. And both of them seem to be reflected to some extent in, as you say, the Age of Beowulf, with both the legends and also the grittiness. So I was wondering how you sought out the influences, not only on Du Phu, but also on yourself for your interest.
Wow. I mean, all I would just preface this by saying is that, of course, the two are seen as the two great poets of China. And in fact, very early on, they get bracketed as Li Du, as if Li Bai and Du Phu were really one person. Li Du, and you can see why. And usually, one is the favorite of people, or the other is the favorite of people. You know, when we went out in China, people were going, "Why do you say he's the greatest poet? Surely, you know, Li Bai is the, you know, those sort of arguments." But they represent in their characters. I almost wonder whether there's some kind of ideal vision of what Chinese people think Chinese people are, you know, and that Li Bai is the wild adventurous, unpredictable risk taker, and Du Phu is the dutiful, kind, loyal, always thinking of the state and so on, you know, and that the two together constitute what Chinese people think is the you know, how one should be in life. I think that's the way one might see them. And it's extraordinary, of course, that they not only lived at the same time, but they actually traveled together for quite a while and knew each other, wrote poetry for each other, although there's a distinct one-sidedness in the relationship in that, you know, Du Phu writes quite a few things about Li Bai, and it at times it almost seems like unrequited love. And your last question was about, sorry, the last part of your question was
where they both seem to be reflected in the literature of
You can't underestimate what a Chinese classical education is, and Du Phu tells us that in his teens and twenties he travelled all over China. He went to all the great historical places, and you can see him imbibing the great myths of China, the landscapes of China. Quite a few famous Chinese writers tell you the same thing. The greatest, the grand historian of China, Sun Ma-Tsien, does exactly the same thing. Long travels, seeing these things, imbibing the myths. And he's as conversant with the myths as Shakespeare is, you know, and you with the Western myths, or Ovid, you know. These things are so ingrained that they can access them all the time. And of course, as a literary critic, you know, or a literary reader, you know, you kind of need to know what they're talking about in order for to really appreciate the poems. So, you know, you take a poem like the one in the Gorges that I read to you about that wonderful night vision from a knight in the tower, and the old hero's leaping horse and so on. I mean, it helps to know those stories, but you don't need to know them in detail to appreciate the fantastic, you know, power of the metaphor. But they had encyclopedic memory of the myths and the stories and the poetry and Dufu's range of reference in his poems is absolutely staggering. You know, he knows the ancient poetry of the past in a way that is hardly possible for a modern person to even begin to understand.
Michael, I'm afraid our hour with you is up. Thank you so much for that incredibly inspiring and exciting adventure. Get well. We very much hope to see you next year. Thank you very much indeed.